program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
At the races with Steve Bick.
Enough!
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back into hour two, and as promised, I did want to get Sid Fernando to come back after Monday's absolutely tremendous visit. And I don't know if you I don't know how much of it you saw, Sid, because you were traveling. But here's Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale, and the explanation you provided people of how the share system works, the 40 shares, what everybody got and what they get out of that, and then how, you know, the financial structure. It actually harkened back to Satish Sanand's wonderful, you know, inside the industry discussions, which we used to call our industry. And the last time we had that this kind of conversation, it was with Satish explaining the marketing of a sire. And I got a bunch of feedback, and I'm sure you did, about how appreciative people were that they've never really heard that portion of it explained. And of course, it was so germane because literally an hour and a half after you explained it, here was this absolutely wild $4.6 million share purchase under gavel.
Yeah, it was quite something. I mean, we were there for a very historic auction. And yes, thanks. But yeah, the feedback that I've received on that explanation actually prompted me to write. I'm writing my column for TBN right now, which will come out later today for tomorrow's paper. But it's going to touch on some of the stuff that I explained to you about how this stuff works and the composition of the shareholders and how this came about, how it was cobbled together, because the, you know, as everybody knows, it's a 40 share syndicate, and that 40 share syndicate was basically the entire ownership group of Flightline, which is the Ronis family, Jane Lyon of Summer Wind, Terry Finley's West Point partnership, Anthony Manganiello's Sienna Farm, and Bill Farish and Partners, Woodford Racing. So that entire ownership group, as the horse got retired, it was just translated to the same ownership group, and fractional interest become actual shares. So the reason it was listed as a 2.5% fractional interest while the horse was racing is that 2.5% of 40 is one share. So it was the one share that was put on the marketplace, and it's a 40 share syndicate. And what that means is that every shareholder will have the right to send two mares to the horse, which we discussed before. So now, for the first time, that original ownership structure has a new shareholder in it, an owner from, you know, Seattle who's in the coffee business, and you know, paid the $4.6 million, which is, you know, an incredible, incredible price for this horse, for a share in the horse. So, you know, that was very historic just for Keeneland to have that auction and for the price that it made.
It, one aside, before I ask you what kind of, you know, what kind of murmuring you've heard out of this, and how in reality it impacts the valuation, because it's such a unique circumstance. But one thing that occurred to me, Sid, afterward, you know, while people were saying, well, they can't possibly recoup this number, there is the possibility that you could, that he could sell any number of year, if he was to keep one yearling, let's say he's going to go forward, you know, keeping the fillies and selling the colts and using that kind of a philosophy, and it wouldn't take, it's not going to take very long to sell a couple of seven figure yearlings, and that extra, you know, that extra deep pocket is offset readily, isn't it?
Well, you know, there's all sorts of ways theoretically that you can make money on it. You know, again, the idea is this is a horse that's a trophy horse to begin with. You know, that's why people pay $7 million for Gamin, and, you know, prices, you know, that people think are trophy mare prices. I mean, it's the same thing here. The price is what, you know, in this auction case, the price came down to what two people thought this horse was worth. Coolmore was the underbidder at $4.5 million. And it's preposterous, by the way, thinking, you know, I saw, you know, Ray Pollock saying that, you know, Freddie Seitz has tons of integrity, but this is suspicious, the sale. There's nothing suspicious about it. You know, agents buy horses all the time for non-disclosed buyers. At the sale at Keeneland, that's how they're normally done. Nobody's questioning it. It's just that this horse was a big price, and there is a legitimate owner who bought it. You know, the conspiracy theories are whack, and somebody decided it was worth $4.6 million. Coolmore thought it was worth $4.5 million. You know, and think about it. If, you know, Coolmore paid $7 million for Gamin, what if they bred a Gamin to Flightline, and that yearling, say it's a perfect yearling. What if that yearling comes out and makes $3 million? Suddenly, they've only paid, you know, $1.5 million for the share now.
Exactly. I mean, the potential residual value is there's just no way to know. And so the fact that it's a unique entity, and for those that speculated on the high side, that came to fruition. You know, we had heard Sunday night from a certain party that somebody had said this will go for 4.5, and that ended up being completely accurate, as outlandish as it seemed at the time. What, you know, from a industry, you know, pulse taking, Sid, what, you know, what did you sense out of this? What have you heard since Monday afternoon?
Well, you know, it's obviously, if you're in this industry, you know, no one expects prices like that until they happen. And, you know, it happens for marquee mares, like I said, all the time. Mandy Pope buys huge mares, you know, Coolmore has, these guys have. And, you know, again, it's not outlandish in the sense that this is such tightly controlled. This is probably the most tightly controlled syndicate I've seen on a horse. Going, you have to go back into the 70s maybe to find a more tightly controlled horse. You know, that means the ownership really you'd have to buy seasons to get to them. You can't buy a share, in other words, because so far, up until this point, shares aren't being offered on the market. In fact, this particular share that was offered, I'll tell you how it was put together. You know, West Point has seven partners in it on this particular horse. And so the way the share came about was three of those partners each put up a third of their share. So in other words, say you, me, and I don't know, Ray Pollock, say the three of us each had a share each in Flightline, right? We don't want to relinquish all of our share. I don't want to sell my entire share. You don't want to sell your entire share. And Ray Pollock doesn't want to sell his entire share. So what happens is the three of us say, hey, I'll put up a third of my one share. You put up a third, Steve, and Ray will put up a third. And that'll cobble together 2.5%.
Interesting.
And we'll put that up. So if we were to do that, my share, which is a 2.5% fractional interest, I would then have, one point six instead of 2.5.
Right.
You'd have 1.6. Ray would have 1.6, and we each put up 0.8, right?
Yep.
Essentially, 8 and change. So that's how that share got cobbled together and put on the marketplace.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
Now, we promised inside baseball. There it is. That's even further.
Yeah.
That's next level.
It is, and it's. I'll take it to even another level, which is nobody knows the story, but one of those shareholders in West Point had out of the blue called me about a month ago. He's not a client of mine, nothing, you know. Just called me to get my take on what I thought the value would be. And a month ago, I gave him my opinion. And that was it. That was our phone conversation. Just, you know, he listens to your show. He reads my stuff. And so he called me. I gave him my take on what I thought. And I think that was the impetus to try to, you know, cash out a bit.
Cash off the table, very understandable. And, you know, especially, you know, one thing about this kind of a situation, because I've encountered it, I mean, and even in our little modest scenario, there's people that that want racing action when they get involved in a partnership, and they are less interested in the long play, the long-term action involved in breeding partnerships. And then there's just as many, you know, there's a whole different class of potential stakeholder in the industry that likes the concept and has that long-term investment strategy mentality. I mean, this is yet another example of how the game can appeal to all different kinds of intellects and people with different predilections, and the same is true in horse players, you know, in terms of how you approach the game. So it's very interesting, and some people just, you know, they recognize that this is a unique financial gain that invariably people who take money off the table, they're going to take that money off the table and then put it right back in the game in other horses and other investments in the game. So,
in this case, it's interesting because the West Point Group, you know, and these guys, they didn't all cash out that. Like I said, they only gave. So now what's happening is West Point has decided to create a breeding
right
entity. And so now they're buying mares, as you see, to breed the fight line. So it's this racing syndicate, just if you look at the West Point part alone, is now getting into the they don't want to relinquish their position in the horse. And so they're now getting into the breeding aspect of it and hoping to breed mares and sell the foals and generate income in a different manner for them. So it's a really unique horse. I was fortunate to get to see the horse right after the auction. He's a stunning individual. And, I was just blown away seeing how intelligent and kind this horse was for the type of, racehorse he was. It's like watching a prize fighter just clobber somebody and then a day or two later meeting him. And he's just, very gentle, intelligent, kind guy and not the stereotypical brute you would think.
Right.
That was kind of the impression I got when I was able to see the horse.
Well, and every indication on that front that we got from listening to John Sadler on Monday and David and Gordo too, about what a kind and relaxed and agreeable trainee that he was, albeit very talented and fast and had to be managed. But Sadler made it very clear that this was a horse that understood all the assignments, and that goes a long way. So often, famously, American Pharoah was the same way.
Another one. Yes, exactly. Great comparison. Yeah.
I happened to very inadvertently at Belmont happened to get pressed onto the little parapet, that little concrete step area in the winner's circle as he came in. And there's that famous picture that's taken from the boxes looking down on the winner's circle. And there's this huge crush in the winner's circle of people right up against him. And at no point, this is a horse that just ran a mile and a half, and at no point was there even a hint that he was, going to get riled or bothered. I'll give you another example. When they brought him out, happened just inadvertently to have been invited to Stephen Foster night by Churchill to broadcast leading into Foster, which is, typically when trophy presentation is done, the engraved Derby trophies. And they paraded American Pharoah that night, Baffert and Lalo and Jimmy Barnes and Victor Espinosa was there. They had him out on display for an hour and 20 minutes before he finally started to get a little tzehitzed and a little irked and was indicating enough of this. But an hour and 20 minutes being led in front of the stands, being walked around the paddock at Churchill, it was unbelievable. When Baffert brought him out at Belmont after the next morning, or Derby, when he basically just stood there for people, with people crowding around and petting him. It takes a special mentality. Try that with Stormcat. you wouldn't have a happy result.
Yeah, and absolutely. Another thing I wanted to say about the price and what it's worth to somebody is this. These people buy yearlings for millions all the time. If they're going to pay $4.6 million and they've got a big broodmare band and they want to breed horses ultimately to race, you know, you get it's like you're spending $4.6 million. You don't have to pay any stud fees. And you get a chance to breed some of your best mares to the stallion. And what if they become, you know, they themselves, the offspring, become great horses and so forth. You know, in a few years down the line, that looks like money well spent. You know, people are so concerned about looking at the nitty-gritty financial returns and, you know, having a bias themselves about what they or they wouldn't do, what they would or wouldn't do. But for you know, a breeding entity like Coomer, for example, it'd be a great opportunity for them to breed two mares every year for 4 years, or actually for the rest of his horse's career. And, you know, if he hits as a sire, you know, what if he turns into a stallion like Frankel? That would have been a drop in the bucket, Steve.
Mm. Yep. Well, it's amazing. This is the greatest unscripted drama. Whether and in this case, not even the drama on the racetrack, the drama off the racetrack. What did you make? By the way, what did you have you had a chance to go watch that metaverse video of? You know, of him standing in the, you know, in the cartoon ring there.
Well, I was actually there in
right.
the ring when he was. Yeah,
but subsequently, I mean, did you watch?
No.
Yeah, it's up there.
No,
it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's very funny.
No, I haven't done that, but it was a historic thing, wasn't it? And to be there, it was kind of exciting to see it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, it was like, wow. I mean. You know, on your show, by the way, I had said, you know, again, just on a purely financial back of napkin math type of thing, that, you know, on a purely financial basis, maybe, you know, $3 million is fair value. And I said in an auction setting, you know, maybe get $3.5 million because of the, you know, pumped up interest. You know, I went for $1.1 million more than that. But when you sit back and look at it for what, like I said, potential breeder, if he really believes in this horse too, and he gets to breed to this horse for the rest of his life, then, you know, as mind-numbing as these numbers are, it's a different view of it from their points of view. And we've got to understand that, you know, we can't analyze everything based on our own views of what numbers are. Everybody has a different aspect to it that they bring.
Well framed, and you know what the goals are long term, and it sounds, based on what Freddie Seitz said, you know, it sounds like he wants to, you know, graduate into a you know, a next level, and that this will be a quantum leap forward in terms of his involvement, and that in and of itself, Sid, is encouraging.
Yeah, this guy, by the way, he's been listed in Forbes magazine, okay? He's not some ghost. People just don't know who he is yet. But, you know, Seattle, coffee, do your research, brah.
I love it. Sid, one other thing, because I did bring it up with Christy, and I'm sure you'll address it in your, you know, in your piece in Taking Stock. In TDN tomorrow, what influence, if any, will this have on that final decision as to the announced stud fee?
Well, you know, I've always maintained the stud fee is going to be $200,000. I can't see the stud fee changing. Who knows? Anything could happen, you know, like I said, but, you know, from my... I don't have any official word yet. I'm aware that it's going to come out today. It'll be released today. But you know, I would say he's going to go to stud at 200,000, which would equal, you know, American Pharoah. Although American Pharoah's 200,000, maybe with an asterisk, since they later formulated it to, you know, breeding two mares to him. with some concessions. And but to take, for the sake of argument, he, this horse, say if he's 200,000, it would be the same as American Pharoah at 200,000. Before that, there was Ghost Zapper at 200,000 in 2006. And before that, in the days of the small syndicate, when Devil's Bag was syndicated for $36 million, he stood for 200,000. So, you know, it would equal the probably the highest entering values of stallions, but it certainly won't be the most expensive horse this year, because there are going to be 14 horses this year in 2023 that stand for six figures. And, you know, published wise, the highest is Into Mischief at 250, followed by Curland at 225. But in reality, one horse that's going to be listed as private, Gunrunner, his stud fee will be the highest.
Well,
and I know what that is. But I'm not at liberty.
I got you.
Yeah, I'm not at liberty to say. But the only reason I know what that is because for, you know, my client Charles 50 Chuck is breeding two mares to Gunrunner. One of them of interest will be Lady Spite Spear.
Off of the placement. Nice.
Yeah, well, she'll have one more start in the Pegasus turf against Colts end of January, and from there she'll go to his farm. You met his farm manager, Elke Krohn.
Yeah.
And you also met Chuck. And from there she'll go to Gunrunner.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, said... like I mentioned on Monday, and I'll reiterate, because I also earlier had Dick Powell, just a tremendous job. We were going over the results again from the betting side and Cheryl Spite and what that meant for people. And then there's people that just, you know, were aware of FIPKE runners just by virtue of how often they come up. And those that included Lady Spite Spear as well in their plays. So thanks much.
I have to give a quick shout out to my man Liam O'Rourke at Windstar Farm. He's the guy who does all the stallion nominations.
Yeah.
Liam made, I mean, his beautiful two vests for me and Chuck. Two vests each for me and Chuck, and they were this beautiful old retro type of vest. Really high quality, but with the Breeders' Cup logo on one side, on the other side, Spite's Town. And underneath the Breeders' Cup logo, they put the two vests. One has Cheryl Spite and the other Lady Spite Spear. So I want to thank Windstar and Liam for that.
I love it. Excellent. You see, it is fun to come to these. And in fact, right here on the sales ground, you see a lot of, you know, a lot of merchandised you know, stallion material and also personalized too. I mean, it's kind of funny. And the vest, the quilted vest brigade is the funniest part is get Chuck Simon talking about this. Chuck marvels at the fact that even down at Gulfstream and in Ocala, you know, when it's 93 degrees, there's the bloodstock brigades that are still wearing their vests, no matter how hot it is. It's like a uniform.
That's actually if you look at the picture you just posted of me and David and Gordon from your show on Monday, we're both of us are wearing vests.
Yeah, exactly. David.
Except mine, I wear over a jean jacket. That's the difference.
Well, David, right? David is one of the. No matter how warm it is, David's got a vest on. I think doesn't what is it? Patty Miller? Does she? always there's certain people in the bloodstock side that there are constantly, every time you see them, they're wearing a vest like those vests. It's a premium item. I've even adopted it a little bit. I'm up to probably a half a dozen myself. So
there you go.
I can appreciate it. Sid, this was great. Thank you so much. And I know people that, you know, were very curious about this, so it's very helpful.
Yeah, you got it, Steve. I'll talk to you next week.
You got it. Sid Fernando, everybody. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. And we're hoping that we're still going to have a conversation with John Sakura, who's been just so busy. Garrett O'Rourke is actually going to push Garrett back a little bit because his Angel Palm is in the ring right this minute, actually. 635 is selling, and this is a daughter of Dark Angel, a 4-year-old, and he said we're going to sell this. We got to sell this filly, and then he will he'll be eligible to join us. But I think what I've got to do actually is reach for Drew right now. Drew Cotney is going to join us here because he's got kind of a tight window himself the next couple of days. So I'm going to reach for Drew, and then we'll take, after we're done with Drew, we'll take a top of the hour break. They're up to 225,000 now on Angel Palm. So after Drew joins us, we'll take the hour three break. We'll come back with Garrett O'Rourke from Judmont. But right now, one of the great honors that we have on the show is the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge winner conversation. And Drew Cotney, congratulations.
Thank you. The honor is all mine to be on the pot, be on your show right now. And no, I just have so many thanks to give to everyone. Thanks, Steve.
Drew, you know, this is always fascinating, especially for aspiring contest players. And, you know, it was interesting. I usually, especially down the stretch, I typically am watching, you know, like the last 3-4 races, the leaderboard. I kind of lost track, and things got a little hectic, and I'm not playing for a chance to win $500,000. But I had seen Friday and the leaderboard on Friday, and then when I did go and look, I saw that pretty much everybody that was prominent on Friday had faded away. Before we talk about the end game, talk about your experience going in and your thoughts going in to the weekend.
Yeah, it all started with strategy. I've been crafting a lot of this tournament strategy thanks to who at the table, Brad Anderson, the 2019 champion, and
yeah,
Matt Miller, the 2021 champion. It was all about how do you build a strategy with the least amount of things that need to go right? So increasing your probability and the chance of winning. And for me, it was a $100,000 win bet on Flightline. That was going to give what I thought was a target of 140, which typically wins this thing. That was the whole goal. So my idea was I'm going to have $5,700 on Saturday morning. And heck, I walking in on Saturday, you kind of feel like a dead man walking, but, you know, stick to the strategy. And my wife was with me the whole way, which made this event that much more special. And she helped curate the tickets to make sure that we had the minimums achieved. I was running the math behind the scenes as well to make sure that specific targets were being hit so that, you know, you just don't swing and get 100,000. You got to have a couple things go right. And it was kind of outer body. For about 3 hours there, I lost myself on the leaderboard, I think, for a while.
Two things before we talk Saturday. How many times had you played BCBC going in?
I hadn't played BCBC ever. This was my first time, and I radically changed my game. I was an early horizontal player. The In the Money Players podcast was key to my upbringing as a horse player, and a lot of those picks like JK would give out were pick fours, pick fives, and sixes, and that's how I played. And I was finding myself getting just ground out trying to beat the takeout. So
shifted my game thanks to Matt Miller's help and coaching to say, look, pick spots, and this is the best spot, especially if you can treat this money once it's in, like Monopoly money to a degree. You're trying to play a game and play the best hand you can, and sometimes you have to be aggressive to get it. So, you know, a couple people have been asking the question, well, you know, how can you do it on a smaller scale? The second place runner-up qualified that week with $56. I mean, what a cool story. The name escapes me right now, but what a cool story to be able to turn 56 into over 200,000. So qualifiers were something I had been really trying to do, didn't get there, and ponied up the cash, and away my wife and I went.
Unbelievable. And you're talking about Jim Vitatek that finished second and ended up with 124. His bankroll ended up at 124,636. You ended up at just a tick under 140,000, 139,953. You said you came in with 5,600 into Saturday, so you basically took kind of a defensive posture on Friday. Talk about what you did play on Friday, to essentially tread water.
Yeah, and the idea was on Friday, see if a double will pay will get up into the 5 or 6,000, just to have a little bit more cushion and take maybe one more shot on Saturday. And I knew a lot of players were going to be pushing hard on Silver Knot and Cape Rock, and maybe one of the chinks in my armor of handicapping is being a little bit too contrarian. And I, lo and behold, decided to pass on both of those races and play some other ideas and just take minimums out of the way. I think there was a Love Rains double in there somewhere and a couple others that were, you got to look at two-year-olds as somewhat volatile. And I think Forte or Ford, I've heard it said both ways, I think is a great example of how these horses are progressing at such a young age, and you can't take anything for granted.
Pause here before we talk about Saturday and walk through, the blow-by-blow. What is your normal, not so much the specific of wagering approach as much as your handicapping approach? What do you look for? How has even that changed? If you say that you find your game evolving, talk a little bit about decision making process and finding win candidates and then horses to maybe pair up with them if that's going to be the approach.
Yeah. And handicapping approach has changed from I'm right to let's absorb as much as I possibly can from everyone and everyone's opinion. And I think modern games, and I write publicly for In the Money Media, and I was against modern games through and through. And at the Woodbine Mile, modern games proved me drastically wrong. And so walking into Saturday, I knew that was going to be a big play. But otherwise, handicapping is about trying to look at the most likely winners and not where all of the wise guy opportunities, so that if the likely things happen, again, trying to increase probability, I'm in a position to be able to make a score of a lifetime. So, one thing I recommend to people that have been asking is take your $100 you have on a Saturday, treat it like dead money, and try and turn it into a target. Look at, see, can you build 100 into 1,000? And make sure you bet all 100 and think through how can you get to whatever your target is and work through the strategy. And those are little contests on your own. And that's how I got started a couple of years ago, honing this craft so that when the decisions come, they become much more automatic instead of having to try and think through, well, what's this person going to do or what's that person going to do? And I think one of the things that at our table, and I have to give a huge shout out to everyone at the table, Brad Anderson, Matt Miller, Nick Tamaro and his consultation, and Kyle Roscoe was a huge supporter of us as well, and my wife, and many more. But it was just a fantastic, fantastic opportunity, and we were able to, my wife and I were able to get it done, so couldn't be more thankful.
All right, get into Saturday then, and it sounds as if the entire process and the construct was to, you know, get to the Classic, knowing how this contest has ended, you know, year in, year out, being in a position to bet the bankroll, essentially, on Flightline. And when did you make up your mind in the scheme of things that was the end game and nothing else mattered, really?
On Wednesday night.
Wednesday.
I had refined the strategy for the most part. There were a couple unknowns on the early part. You have to dance on your toes a little bit. But the key three steps were 100,000 on Flightline, knowing that if Flightline, the horse of a lifetime, the bet of a lifetime, even if I didn't win, still going to provide tremendous economic value, getting the public getting 2 to 5. And even if I did get snapped by any of the greats, like Sean Borman had a tremendous play, and I have to give all due respect to that player and how much he's taught me. But at the end of the day, I was still going to be able to get at least 3 to 1 on a horse of a lifetime. So on Wednesday, that decision was made. The next step was Modern Games exiting the turf mile with at least 40, and then being able to just smash the distaff as well and cutting it up as best as the tote board would allow me to, and being able to catapult to the $100,000 mark.
Then back us up. I mean, go through Saturday's plays, and these will be all published as soon as all the editing, all the profiling is done, and the Breeders' Cup will publish everybody's plays, and it's always edifying. But kind of walk through the day, and also Drew Cotney's with us, who won the BCBC with 140,000, which was actually, you said earlier, basically the goal, the number that has been a magical level. But start out early on the card Saturday. Explain to everybody, you know, how many wagers had to be made, and you know, how you went step by step.
Yeah, so I knew I could pass two races, and the first of the Breeders' Cup races was a pass for me with Goodnight Olive. I didn't have a strong opinion. One of my handicapping approaches is looking at replays and watching who did the horse pass, how was the horse handled, and I just thought on the day it was going to be too much with too many big players in there. So that was a pass, and I knew I had one more pass, assuming all in doubles were going to be put somewhere. So next race was Cody's Wish, which at minimum, I think I had $250 doubles, Cody's Wish in Italian and in Tuesday, which is a fantastic day of the week now for me. And then a $50 simplification into those two as well. At that point, I'm sorry, I missed one step. I had $2,500 on Highfield Princess. So down to $3,200, and then Cody's Wish started for the plays. So $3,200, got a minimum done, $600, Cody's Wish into those two horses with a little bit of simplification mixed in.
And and where are you when Tuesday closes out the double, where are you?
So before that happened, I went all in on Tuesday.
Oh,
I knew I needed to make a move early because the turf was going to be just too many question marks with all the Euros and how they were performing. Some were and some were. That I needed to make a move earlier in the day. So the biggest play was putting $2,600 on Tuesday into Jackie's Warrior. And that was going to pay around $30,000, which was the target I was looking to then be able to put more money into Modern Games. So Tuesday hit, and I was able to take the Tuesday money. So from here on out, I'm all in. Every race except for the turf, I'm all in. Had about 4,585. Played Jackie's Warrior for half of that into two horses I was scared in the turf mile with Regal Glory and Dream Loper. Again, making sure the target of 40,000 was going to be achieved so that 40,000 could be leveraged on Modern Games. But also 2,500-ish on Elite Power, another horse I loved, if Jackie's Warrior just couldn't push on the pressure.
Look at that.
I'm just so excited at this point. Elite Power into Modern Games. So one way or the other, if Modern Games won and Elite Power Jackie's Warrior won, I was going to have 40,000 and a couple backups. Obviously, Jackie didn't win. Elite Power did, and then it was all on Modern Games.
Modern Games, that double, the 6-4 double for a buck pays $18.07. And you've got that how many times?
2,300.
Nice. So there's the 40. There's the 40. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and then in order of preference in the distaff, I knew Clairiere was a must play for me, top pick. And Ness just wasn't going to get it done for me to achieve the $100,000 mark. And next horse, and consulted with the rest of the table, and Tamaro made a tremendous push for Malathaat, and the rest was history to Dutch a win bet to get to 100,000. So once the distaff rolled around, the story was written.
Wow. And so now you're up to the turf, which you're ambivalent about anyway, and you don't really have to, you don't really have to do any, you know, acts of desperation to try to be in a position of viability for the Classic, and that puts you in. What did you? Where were you after the distaff? Where were you in the standings?
I don't know after the distaff. So my table kept asking, "Do I want another leaderboard?" And to me, it really didn't matter.
Interesting.
Yep. 140 was the target, and that was what I was going to get to. So I believe I was up to 97.8, and I think the next closest was around 50.
Wow. I'm sorry. Normally, I've done screen caps, Drew, of you know, after each of the last like three or four, and it was such a. Such a frenetic late portion of the day, and frankly, that distaff. Tell people what it's like when you're also excited about the actual race. That it isn't just a sterile scenario of okay, let's see, okay, good, I got this now, and now I'm in position. But I mean, there's an excitement factor that has to be somewhat contained, despite how thrilling the race was.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. Best way to put it was I'm typically a route down the stretch type of guy at the track, and I was sitting with Kyle Roscoe. We had some superstitions, so my wife went off with Matt Miller and Brad Anderson, the rest of the table, and I would sit with Kyle and watch the races. And there isn't anything to get excited yet because you're still playing the game, and the game is to win the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. And that nose sweat with Blue Stripe and Malathaat and Clairiere was challenging, but the same token, you know, people ask me, are you okay with, PTF and Jonathan Kitchen are calling me, and it's out of our control at that point. We as horse players have to realize that at a certain point that if the strategy is sound, you're likely going to be more right than wrong, and I've been wrong a lot. You know, go look at any qualifications that were tried to be had in the Breeders' Cup, and everything just worked perfect for me in this scenario. So I've been saying it was kind of poetry in motion and out of body, being able to do what just happened last weekend.
Had you reached, so were you able to sit out the turf, or did you have to get a minimum in too?
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, my wife, Nancy, was tremendous because at one point the leaderboard showed I was a minimum short. And on track, we had betting cards with tote machines, and 500 is the max. So when you go through and bet, I forget what the final number was on Malathaat and Clairiere, roughly 40 or 50,000, there's a lot of tickets to go through and scroll up on the machine itself to make sure your minimums were hit. So she was keeping all of my tickets in the organization ready for us. And I was able to be able to produce the information to Tim Tram and team and knew I was good. And she kept me on track as well. Hey, I know you just wagered a massive amount of money, but you got to go bet $600 on one horse in this turf. Just get it done. Like, show me the receipt. And I'll hold on to it to make sure the minimum was done. So did have to do the minimum because, again, I knew it was going to be live in a double at some point, all in push, and that was the Modern Games one, where I'd have no ammo to be able to fulfill a minimum. So everything had to work just perfectly, and it just did. So turf, $600 Mishriff, and thank goodness I wasn't in a desperation mode, because that wouldn't have panned out too well.
So now there is the, you know, the time, and I'm just looking here, four, the turf goes off at 4:42, the classic goes off at 5:42, so there is 1 hour, essentially, and then figure about 8 or 9 minutes after the turf, the dust settles, so there's 45 minutes, and how is that, explain to everybody how you spend that 45 minutes.
Yeah, and it helps, too, when you have transparency with your family and close ones of what you're trying to achieve, because if you know, news comes out, right, God forbid, Flightline didn't finish first, that transparency with your family and close ones is critical to say this is why, and the logic is sound, and 100,000 is the target. So it was somewhat of a foregone conclusion, but I still had to punch in, punch in 198, roughly $500 wagers over and over and over again. It took 16 minutes at the machine, and I called some of the closest supporters I have. Jonathan Kinchin gave me the "I'm proud of you" speech, and you're doing the right thing, and Peter Thomas Fornatel as well, and then called my dad and talked to him about what was transpiring, and he's not a horse player, but he understood the reasoning, logic, and said Godspeed and love you, and you're just trying to go through the routine. And I think that's something that, whether it's superstition or not, being able to have a routine in a racetrack, even if I don't spend every day at Keeneland, but being able to go through that routine helped clear my head and let the horses and the equine athletes that they are do their thing. And what better horse to be confident going into a gate than Flightline, and seeing what the valuation of Flightline is coming out to be at the massive $100+ million price point. So fairly confident, but at the same time stoic. And there's a reaction video similar to the Bay Chalk with the 2012 NHC, where it was an emotional overflow as they were coming down the stretch.
Well, as you watch the race, what did you anticipate in terms of how it might unfold?
They went fast. I've listened to your show this week. I think everyone agreed, and love to hear Andy Beyer as well just talk about the greatness that horse showed. And there was a moment middle of the far turn where I thought, I don't know what's going to happen here. But Kurt Becker's voice said, and three lengths, and two, and one length. And he has taken over. And it was, it was, like I said, a little bit of poetry in motion. It gives me chills still talking about it. And, you can't root in those situations. It's just, for me, it was just too emotional and too much, because this is why we play the game, to be put in these spots and to sit on my hands and say, let's, you know, someone else come catch me. Instead, I had an opportunity to take a big old freaking sledgehammer and get to 140 versus the opportunity for others to maybe take a long shot sniper range attack at a low probability. And the rest was done. And as they crossed the wire, I got a few phone calls of, I think you got beat. My wife actually had Flightline over Olympiad. She told me how much she won. And I said, oh no. That can't be good. But at the same time, again, going back to the kind of emotional or mental level-headedness, it's can't control it. I did exactly what I wanted to do. I couldn't believe it. There's so many better horse players out there, and was just able to execute and get the right head bobs to go my way. And at that point, I didn't know if I won. I think it took about 15 minutes, and walked over to the people that were helping me at Keeneland. A couple attendants. Keith was one of the attendants who was letting us stand and hold our spot, and our server as well, Adrian, tipped those folks and said, thank you so much. You know, whatever happens, I just want to let you know, we appreciate you, and talk to Jim Goodman as well and said, I appreciate you, whatever happens. And also Tim Schramm, and said thanks and said, let me know. And I walked over and I was by myself, just some random Chicago guy, and talked to Tim, and he said, you did it. You got him. So it was a little bit of, that's when the route began for me as I stepped out onto the apron.
Unbelievable. It's just tremendous. I mean, and to come within $47, $46.89 of exactly the number that you expected to win it. And Vitatech, $124,636. Charlie Thompson, $103,000 essentially. Dave Schenvert and the always potent and dangerous Schenvert team, $94,167, and he came from downtown, so he must have taken the Olympiad and Taba trifecta, which paid $83 essentially for a buck. He must have had that in some combination. Vic Stauffer made a sizable move to be fifth. Vic, a strong contest player, $88,387. Jeff Sandler made a move, $55,565. That was the top six. Mark Stanton, who had been sitting fourth going into the feature, $49,000 to be seventh. Brad Allhouse, $45,604. Joe Johnson was ninth, $44,730. And John Hewitt, $43,254. There's your top ten. And plenty of familiar names down. And one of the things, including Doc Treza, who finished 18th, he's a menace. Justin Mustari was 13th. Plenty of familiar names, Drew. And what also is amazing, if you scroll down the entire leaderboard, when you see some of the biggest names that absolutely end up, zero. And it, in a lot of ways, it is an all or nothing proposition. You know, there are others that, that get to a certain point and realize, well, I put in 10,000, I can get out of here with something close to that, just above, just below. But between the bankroll and the prize money, what'd the prize money end up at?
I think it was 409, I believe, was the total on the prize money for first place. I'm not sure the other places.
Very nice. So the entire total, and this is, this qualifies as life enhancing.
Yes. Yeah. It definitely is going to help with some things in life, but I'm not a huge bettor. I don't go to the windows with six-figure bets or even five-figure bets, and just the scenario that the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge provides, if you do approach it in the right mentality, that this is a very specific game selection decision that, it just takes a couple pick-six tickets to save throughout the year, and now you are put in an opportunity on one of the biggest stages and the biggest days of racing to do something great. And I'm just fortunate for everyone that was along the way with me, as well as all the things that had to go right, from listening to Matt Bernier and Peter Thomas Fornatale and even your show, Steve, to become somewhat of that insider in the industry when I didn't have anyone to teach me handicapping or what it was. So eternally grateful for all the people, including yourself.
It's very kind, and that's what this game is supposed to be, and the experience, it's communal, and there's plenty of people out there that'll be inspired, Drew, by the story and by the execution and a plan and an approach, and I imagine, you got to feel like this is something that emboldens you and gives you that much more confidence going forward. I mean, how old?
34. Wow. And I think it does provide some confidence, but at the same token, game selection is still at the top of my list, and that old adage of don't give it back faster type of scenario. So making sure that the right investments are made with the money and continuing to, at the backyard of Saratoga, There'll be maybe a couple more four-figure wagers, but it's all about game selection and making sure that you don't give it back faster than you got it.
Well, and you talked about the evolution and your growth as a player, but I mean you've really immersed yourself in the game as well, because you're handling the business affairs. And I first met you with Pete, you basically handling all the business affairs for In the Money. And so, I mean, you've immersed yourself in the sport, and it's got to be very gratifying to be rewarded this way, to think that you've got, a level of knowledge that can be leveraged into successes like this, and understanding the signposts along the way, and it sounds like your whole interest on this side of it has evolved and changed, and it should inspire others to take their interest and try to grow it and appreciate that if you're not successful initially, there's a path forward, and it's trial and error. It for those of you that think you don't really have a friend, maybe your circle of friends aren't horse players, and you're intrigued. I mean, you've got a community. It's one of the best things about the internet, frankly. There's a community out there to participate with. It's one of the reasons that even some of, frankly, even some of the more divisive personalities that are out there are actually having a positive influence, because people are very quietly reading or listening and absorbing, and it's helping them. And that, from that standpoint, Drew, this is a win for everybody.
Yeah, and my victory lap is over at this point. That ended on maybe Monday, when I finally emotionally recovered and physically from the dinners. But it's now on to exactly what you said. How can I use this platform to be a better ambassador and show people that there is a way and a pathway to have fun with this and be connected, regardless of the dollar values you're wagering. That should be the last of the concerns. But having fun and making sure that people are continuing to grow their education. And I've had so many phone calls from people I've never met. Marshall Graham gave me, I was in a slump maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And, hey, old pick one, stop playing in horizontals. Look at your ROIs and those fools. What's happening? I mean, the list goes on of, just putting yourself out there a little bit. The kindness and generosity from all of the horse players and the tribe that we are, everyone wants to see the grain grow, and that's that's my mission now.
I love it. You can follow Drew on Twitter, Drew Cotney, Cotney, and Drew, just delighted for you, and continued success, and now you're in that pantheon of defending winners, and now you got to try to parlay it into a the first NHC/BCBC dual winner, and there's so many interesting things that come out of this.
That's fantastic, and pantheon is way too strong of a line there, because Flightline is a pantheon of great horses. I just got lucky a couple times in the day and had a strategy. And now I'm just delighted and looking forward to meeting everyone out at the NHC. And my wife will be going out there as well. And the trip to Saratoga, all the fun things that this allows it to happen.
Well, Drew Cotney, well done. And continued success. Thanks so much for this. Oh, it's always one of my favorite conversations of the year.
Thank you.
Drew Cotney, and Drew he's got another full-time gig beside the work that he does with Pete and the In the Money podcast and media items and all the different offerings, and he was there. He was in a lot of ways, I think, and that's probably a separate conversation, really, that a lot of the the impetus was came from Drew. But you could really tell how he plotted this out and then executed the plan. Let's take a break here. We've got about 45 minutes to fill out the morning. This has been another breakneck speed. We've got room. Todd Pletcher is going to join us at 11:45. So we've got room for Garrett O'Rourke. And probably Papo will save Seth Merrow, I think, for tomorrow. Seth, if you're listening, I'm sorry. Leaving you in the green room. You can take your betting companion bow tomorrow. We'll see. Let me get, it might just be Garrett and Todd. Who knows? Hold on. Let's see how that plays out. Garrett O'Rourke from Judmont joins us next. And I want to see what that Philly sold for. It was racing up toward $300,000. So we'll find out more, and we'll talk about Judmont's short-term and intermediate and long-term goals, but it'll all be done through the prism of the surprise win. I think Garrett's going to tell you that they thought they could win a sprint race, but they thought it was going to be the Philly and Mare sprint with obligatory. They weren't as convinced that Elite Power was going to win the sprint. So when obligatory didn't impact the Philly and Mare early in the day, they seemed delighted with the outcome later. Garrett O'Rourke at Judmont. Next, Todd Pletcher and more. Hour three, our last day at Keeneland. Really been a terrific near fortnight. We'll be at Churchill tomorrow as well. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and